DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
Hello and welcome to World in Progress. I'm Jessie Wingard in Bonn. Coming up on the program, increasing urbanisation is causing the loss of arable land and soil across the globe.
The problem is that cities have been built on fertile land. That's because people settled in places where food could be grown to feed the urban population. Now, if you start to expand the cities, this fertile land is being destroyed and the soil is lost for food production.
Also on the show, what's being done to make sure private companies comply with human rights standards?
We have to ensure that international human rights standards are respected and implemented and observed by all stakeholders, including business people and business corporations.
And Stopping the Blame Game, an initiative to compel the world's decision makers to cooperate in international policy making.
Most of the movements of today, like the World Social Forum, they're really based on blaming and shaming somebody else. I think when you understand that, you can start to forgive everybody. And when you forgive, you open your heart. And when you open your heart, you realise we're all in this together. And when you realise that, something like Simpol becomes second nature.
All that and more coming up today on World in Progress. Bangladesh is one of the countries most heavily affected by climate change. Storms and floods are occurring more frequently, and if sea levels continue to rise, millions of people in the densely populated country will be forced from their homes. But the country is also becoming a role model as it finds new ways to adapt to climate change. Some experts say some communities in Bangladesh are among the best prepared in the world as global warming takes hold. One of them is Professor Salim Haq. He's an internationally renowned scholar on climate change issues, a senior fellow at the International Institute for Environment and Development in London, and an expert on community-based climate adaptation in Bangladesh. Haq is currently in Doha at the United Nations Climate Conference as part of the Bangladesh delegation. I spoke with him earlier about why he believes Bangladesh is vulnerable to climate change and why he thinks the country is better prepared to cope with its effects than many others.
What I mean is that although Bangladesh is a very vulnerable country, it's vulnerable to floods, to cyclones, to sea level rise and even indeed droughts. At the same time, there's a very high level of awareness across the country on the problem, and there's been quite a lot of action taking place by governments and others to tackle it. So the government of Bangladesh has developed a very significant climate change strategy and action plan, and they're implementing it with their own money to the tune of about $300 million. And they're inviting international donors to provide additional funds. And the international community has provided another $200 million or so. So they're implementing these activities and doing adaptation on the ground already.
And because of that, Bangladesh has recently been labelled a laboratory of innovation when it comes to climate change adaptation. What do you think other developing nations and also industrialised countries, like the US, for example, are able to learn from countries like Bangladesh?
Well, I think one of the biggest lessons that we've learned so far in Bangladesh that will be applicable to other countries as well is that resilience of society is not necessarily tied to affluence or to technological capabilities. It's much more of a social phenomenon. And for countries to have social cohesion, for people to help each other, for neighbors to help each other, and be able to cope with adversity when it happens, is far more important than having technology solutions and big homes to protect them. They can do some protection, but ultimately it's human beings helping each other and working together that matters.
Many scientists now say that even the target to slow global warming to only a 2-degree rise by 2015 will actually not be met, and that is going to be a 4-degree rise this century. What does that mean for Bangladesh and other developing countries?
Well, it's certainly true that the trajectory we're on now is going to lead us to about 4 degrees by the end of the century, if not sooner. And that doesn't mean just catastrophe for Bangladesh. That is actually catastrophic for many countries, including the rich countries, is something that doesn't want to happen. On the other hand, bending the curve and bringing it down to 2 degrees is certainly possible technologically and financially. It just lacks the political will to make it happen.
You've participated in many climate talks as part of the delegation of Bangladesh. Now, the last few climate conferences were pretty frustrating, I understand, as there was hardly any progress made. Do you personally think it makes sense at all in future to meet for these kinds of meetings, or would it be more helpful to find other forms of moving climate action forward?
Well, actually, other forms have been tried in the past. In fact, President Bush had a major economies forum where he tried to get the major economies to move forward together, and that didn't do much good. So given that it may not be the best game in town, but there is no alternative to it, and it's really the only one in which all countries get represented, particularly the poorest and most vulnerable. Any other forum that tries to make it smaller on the grounds of efficiency is necessarily going to be exclusive of the most vulnerable and the poorest. So this is really the only place where they can have their voices heard. It's certainly unsatisfactory and has not delivered so far, but there are no real alternatives.
We're talking here about what seems to be the world's most complex challenge of the 21st century. Why is there so little movement in international politics while time is running out?
Well, I think the time scales of problems don't match up. The science and the climate change issue is something that's going to run over the next few decades, and it's about a legacy that we, the adults of this generation, are going to leave behind for our children and grandchildren. On the other hand, electoral politics run in just a few year cycles, and for politicians, the immediate crisis is always much bigger than the long-term crisis, which they can put off or leave to their successors. And therefore, we simply haven't got the political will generated to tackle this, because it's seen as something that can be tackled later rather than now.
That was Professor Salim Haq, a senior fellow at the International Institute for Environment and Development in London, speaking from the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Doha. We apologise for the technical quality of that interview. Southeast Asia is not the only continent being hit hard by climate change. Africa is also struggling to cope. Floods in Nigeria, famine and drought in the Sahel, the shrinking of Lake Turkana are all just a preamble of what is to come if the continent doesn't act fast. Mark Caldwell from DW's Africa Link program spoke with Greenpeace Africa's Ruth Malunga. He asked her about the second commitment, an extension of the Kyoto Protocol, which requires developed nations to cut their greenhouse gas emissions by 2012.
Everyone is really looking forward to a second commitment, Mark. I think this is really what the continent is looking for, that Doha will deliver on a second commitment period that doesn't carry over excessive emission rights or hot air allocations, that we will see an actual commitment from this conference that will deliver not only just in terms of the science meeting up with the politics, but as well as the climate fund actually starting to see those contributions coming in.
What have African governments themselves been doing to prepare for climate change?
I think the problem with a lot of African governments is that they are refusing to decouple investment or economic growth away from fossil fuels. Economic growth is still tied to fossil fuels, and this creates huge problems in trying to encourage clean investment, because government backing is still behind coal-fired stations.
Where in Africa is global warming already having an impact? What are the scientists saying?
Greenpeace Africa has documented three particular areas where some of the impacts are already being felt. So, for example, KwaZulu-Natal has seen an increase in the frequency and the severity of snowstorms. Along East Africa, the Lake Turkana region, where the lake is shrinking, and groups of people that previously were not in conflict and had adequate resources are starting to fish, starting to fight. So you have the pastoralists in Kenya that used to be able to have their livestock are now forced to become fishermen. But even that livelihood is in danger as the lake shrinks.
Could it be that global warming turns out to be so severe that adaptation to it simply isn't possible?
Well, there is an opportunity now to act on climate change, and as well as adaptation, to put these measures in now to limit the impact that this will have. Unfortunately, we will see an increase in temperature because the world has been slow on the uptake, but I do feel realistic enough to say that if certain measures are put in place now, the world can adapt and we can have certain measures in place to limit the impact on human life.
Africa Link's Mark Caldwell speaking there with Ruth Malunga about the effects of climate change on the African continent. The talks in Doha are gridlocked as each nation tries to protect its own interests, rather than looking at the bigger picture. It seems international cooperation has hit a number of stumbling blocks in recent years. The global financial crisis tested our ties and left us squabbling and unable to agree on common goals and solutions. We just have real trouble seeing beyond our own borders. But John Bunzel wants to change all that. He's the founder of the International Simultaneous Policy Organisation, or SIMPOL. Its aim is to get national leaders to put issues of global concern ahead of national interests. More than 6,000 people have signed up to the SIMPOL initiative, including 24 British parliamentarians. Bunzel recently spoke at a TEDx Berlin conference about the concept. Cinema Nippard has more.
John Bunzel's idea for simultaneous policy is to make political solutions possible while minimising the bickering among different parties about them.
Basically, the idea is to get all or sufficient governments to implement global problem-solving policies simultaneously, because only if they do that simultaneously can our problems be solved without any individual nation suffering a competitive economic disadvantage.
Citizens play a much more important role in this form of democracy. Every citizen can work on the policies in what Bunzel describes as open source democracy. And citizens also use their vote to support politicians who have signed a pledge for SIMPOL.
If you live in a democratic country, you simply write a little letter to all your politicians and you tell your politicians that you'll be voting in future national elections, not for a particular politician or party, but for any politician or party within reason that has signed a pledge to implement the simultaneous policy if and only if all or sufficient other governments have also signed up. Or if you have a preference for a particular political party, you want your party to sign up. Now, with more and more parliamentary seats and even entire elections being won and lost on quite low numbers of votes these days, it won't take many of us to become a powerful enough bloc to drive the politicians of all parties to sign up to this. So it's a way of turbocharging party political competition to produce global cooperation.
SIMPOL only includes policies which nations cannot implement alone because they fear competitive disadvantage. Yet the path to SIMPOL implementation could be quite a long one. These global policies must first be nutted out and finalised on a national level, and then can only be implemented when all or sufficient nations have signed the pledge to do so. But the advantage is that SIMPOL offers a multi-issue policy framework. The idea is to introduce policies simultaneously, so that no country loses out. For example, introducing a currency transactions tax or Tobin tax and a carbon emissions reduction agreement at the same time. Right now, despite international groups and institutions like the United Nations and the European Union, which aim to resolve certain issues, differing national interests and power struggles mean that gridlocks keep happening, as we keep seeing with the issue of climate change.
It's in a stalemate because essentially we already have a global economy. And you can only have sustainability and justice if you have governance that is on the same scale as the economy it's trying to govern. But we don't have that. We have a global economy, but we essentially only have national governance. And so there's a mismatch between the two, and that mismatch is what's causing all the problems.
Yet Bunzel says that finger-pointing at capitalism and the neoliberal agenda isn't going to get past the gridlock. Torsten Benner, director of the European think tank, the Global Public Policy Institute, agrees that the current form of global governance isn't working.
Currently, we have a very much a top-down system of global governance, leaders convening in closed-door meetings, trying to come to solutions, and if they come to solutions, oftentimes they're not implemented, and there's not really a meaningful citizen engagement across borders.
In recent years, organisations like Avaaz and Change.org have run with the petition model to push change across different issues one at a time. While they have sparked international citizen interest, Benner doesn't believe online petitions or even SIMPOL will actually have enough clout to achieve real change.
I think SIMPOL is onto something in terms of creating this meaningful citizen engagement, but I would much more think that we need social movements across borders, citizens really meaningfully engaging in debates and advocating certain positions on particular issues to counter, for example, the organized interests of business in certain fields, and pressuring their national politicians, just signing these petitions, in a sense, is more like armchair activism. You don't actually do all that much. So I think SIMPOL doesn't necessarily exhaust the opportunities that we presently have in terms of global citizen engagement.
Creating effective citizen engagement across borders isn't easy, says Bunzel. Yet he feels it's time that people stopped blaming others and started working together instead.
Most of the movements of today, like the World Social Forum, they're really based on blaming and shaming somebody else, business, politician, whoever it may be. What we're saying is that people are stuck in a box. Politicians are stuck in a box because they have to maintain their national competitiveness. Companies are stuck in a box because if they do the right thing, they'll only lose out to their less scrupulous competitors. So, you know, everyone's caught in a vicious circle. And I think when you understand that, you can start to forgive everybody. And when you forgive, you open your heart. And when you open your heart, you realize we're all in this together. And when you realize that, something like SIMPOL becomes second nature.
Bunzel says the difference with SIMPOL is that it's about citizen engagement through democracy and voting. In the last UK election, 200 candidates signed on to SIMPOL, 24 of whom are now members of Parliament. SIMPOL is active in 22 countries, including the UK, Germany, Australia, Sweden, Canada, India and Brazil. Yet the idea still faces a number of challenges, not least of which is raising awareness about the concept amongst politicians and citizens, and getting politicians to sign on. Cinnamon Nippard, DW, Berlin.
You're listening to World in Progress, DW's Globalisation and Development show. We're moving now to the corporate sector. And here's a question for you. What should be done to ensure that private companies, especially multinational corporations, comply with legally binding human rights standards? Last year, the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva unanimously adopted the Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights Framework. This week, 1,000 representatives from governments, business and NGOs from around the world took part in a global forum in Geneva. They discussed the implementation of these guiding principles. This report from our Geneva correspondent Andreas Zumach is presented by Sue Cox.
At the opening of the forum, John Ruggie, main author of the guidelines and former special envoy of UN Secretary General for Business and Human Rights, argued that the need for having effective internationally agreed rules to protect human beings in the economic sphere has become more urgent than ever before in the past two decades of globalization.
The rights of multinational corporations to operate globally increased greatly through, for example, more robust and enforceable rules protecting foreign investment and intellectual property. However, the protection of people in this transformed economic environment did not keep pace.
According to the guidelines, companies have to actively prevent slavery, child labor, and any other forms of exploitation in their domain. They should also guarantee safe and decent working conditions in accordance with the core conventions of the International Labour Organization, the ILO, and respect the right of their employees to form a union. The companies are also obliged not to violate the human rights of local populations when they build industrial sites and pipelines, acquire land, or extract food, energy resources or other raw materials in a foreign country. But Ruggie made it very clear that the main challenges still lie ahead.
It's one thing to get principles adopted. It's another to turn them into reality on the ground.
The guidelines are based on three principles: protect, respect, and remedy. That means it is the main responsibility of states and their governments to protect the human rights of all their citizens. Private companies are obliged to respect all international human rights standards, as well as national laws. In doing so, the companies are to exercise due diligence. And if human rights violations happen, it is the common responsibility of both governments and companies to guarantee appropriate measures of remedy. The guidelines should be observed by companies of all sizes. That includes small and medium-sized companies, so-called SMEs, operating only in a national framework, as well as by multilateral corporations, regardless of the national laws and regulations in those countries where they operate. But what have companies and governments done to implement the guidelines since their adoption 18 months ago? The answers to this question at a press conference on Tuesday were not very specific and, in some cases, surprising. For Andrei Galayev, chairman of the Russian energy corporation Sakhalin, the guidelines weren't really necessary to improve the human rights standards at his company.
We were in line with all those principles since we started our activities, and that was before 2000, year 2000.
But Debbie Stothard, longtime human rights activist with the alternative ASEAN network ALCEA, expressed hope that the guidelines will become an effective tool to improve the situations in many countries of her world region.
Like in Burma, for example, or Myanmar, where various laws actually legalize arbitrary land confiscation without compensation, and sometimes having to suffer extreme acts of violence. When we have situations like that, then we have to ensure that international human rights standards are respected and implemented and observed by all stakeholders, including business people and business corporations.
The European Special Representative for Human Rights, Stavros Lambrinidis, announced that the European Commission just published a first human rights manual for business. A second one is currently being drafted and is to be published by April next year.
We just published an introductory guide to human rights for small and medium enterprises. The EU is supportive of the development of human rights guidance for companies in three crucial sectors: oil and gas, ICT, and employment and recruitment agencies. It is critically important to us that this guidance is consistent with the UN guiding principles.
In Switzerland, a local court recently accepted charges brought forward by the European Centre for Constitutional and Human Rights in Berlin against the Swiss-based multinational food corporation Nestlé. The reason? Alleged responsibility of Nestlé's leading managers for the killing of a union activist in the company's affiliate in Colombia. John Ruggie says this and similar cases recently filed in Australia, the USA and other countries make him hopeful that an increasing number of companies and governments take their human rights responsibilities seriously.
These forms of extraterritorial jurisdiction are evolving rapidly at national levels as governments come to recognize that nothing less than the social sustainability of globalization itself is at stake.
That report from Andreas Zumach was presented by Sue Cox. To soils now. Every year, millions of tons of arable land and soil are lost through rapid urbanization. Experts are now trying to find ways to make sure our ever-expanding cities aren't destroying too much of the soil needed for food production and climate protection. Jennifer Fraxek met some of those experts at Global Soil Week, a conference that recently took place in Berlin. Her report is presented by Anke Rasper.
200 years ago, more and more people across Europe began moving to larger towns and cities. Leaving their rural villages and homes behind, they hoped for a better life and an end to their poverty. Those are still the main reasons why people move to cities today, particularly in developing countries, where urbanization started later but is now in full swing. Staggeringly, half the world's population today live in cities. But rapidly increasing urbanization has had devastating effects on the arable land around cities, which is also impacting residents. Klaus Lorenz is from the Institute of Advanced Sustainability Studies in Potsdam.
Wenn ich urbanisiere, dann werden ungefähr 50% des Bodens überdeckt.
If you urbanize a region, about 50% of the soil will be covered by non-permeable materials like concrete or asphalt. That means the soil cannot be used for anything else once it has been covered up.
The Institute of Advanced Sustainability Studies, where Lorenz works, hosted the first Global Soil Week conference in Berlin recently. Every year, some 1,000 square kilometers of land are lost in Europe due to urbanization and construction. But it's not just about the amount of lost land. It's also a matter of the quality of the soil that is lost, says Lorenz.
The problem is that cities have been built on fertile land. That's because people settled in places where food could be grown to feed the urban population. Now, if you start to expand the cities, this fertile land is being destroyed, and the soil is lost for food production.
So should people build skyscrapers instead of using more land for buildings? Sure, it's one solution to the problem of cities, expanding vertically instead of horizontally, but it's not possible in all cities. In Mexico City, for instance, there is an ever-present danger of earthquakes, which limits construction possibilities. However, Klaus Lorenz is in favor of making better use of existing buildings and utilizing free urban spaces, for instance, through green rooftops or urban farming. But he warns it's important to keep in mind that urban soil could be polluted. Soil acidification, for instance, is an increasing problem in China, where dozens of cities with millions of inhabitants are under construction. Guangzhou, China's third largest city with an estimated 16 million inhabitants, now stretches across 10,000 square kilometers. Rapid industrialization has been causing problems, including soil pollution. Now people are trying to clean industrial wasteland of hazardous substances to use it for new purposes. However, that's difficult because there are no regulations for soil remediation in the country. The situation is similar in Brazil. Cristina Nascimento from the University of Fuvon in Pernambuco province says that soil pollution is one of the worst negative effects of urbanization in the country. Landslides also cause many problems. The professor of chemistry says many problems are caused by a lack of urban planning.
We have to reorganize the way people use the land and occupy the land, because the very few cities were planned, and the only few cities had the urbanization plan in there. So you need to reorganize these things to relocate people.
Nascimento feels that Brazilians are not aware of how precious soil actually is.
In Brazil, for example, we have so much land still available that people don't realize that soil is a finite resource, because they travel around the country, and sometimes we can drive 1,000 kilometers with land in both sides, and you don't realize that's a finite resource.
Nascimento hopes conferences like Global Soil Week will contribute to raising awareness about the importance to preserve soil. However, he feels that the perspective of developing countries and emerging economies was not adequately discussed at the forum this year. Usually, documents emerging from such expert meetings are aimed at politicians to raise demands or to change policies. Klaus Lorenz says that consumers, too, should become more aware of the problems connected with soil.
We are simply too far away from the products on our tables, on our plates. We're far away from making the connection that arable soil is necessary to produce this food, and that we simply cannot produce soil. That is impossible. Natural, fertile soils. If they are gone, they are gone.
Anke Rasper for DW.
Well, that's all from World in Progress on DW for this week. Remember, you can keep up to date with development and globalization stories at dw.de/globalization. World in Progress will be back again at the same time next week, so be sure to tune in. I'm Jesse Wingard in Bonn. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.